loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, President Trump said this morning in a series of tweets that he will call out the military to build a border wall if Democrats in Congress fail to provide the necessary funding for the wall's construction. Democrats, meanwhile, warned that Trump could cause a government shutdown on Friday if the Republican Congress does not approve emergency government funding. Next, Maria Butina, a Russian student and gun rights activist accused of failing to register as a foreign agent, has agreed to plead guilty to one count of conspiracy and to cooperate in ongoing federal, state, and local investigations. Butina is expected to tell a federal court in Washington tomorrow that she was working to establish relationships with American political groups at the direction of an unnamed Russian official. But critics of the Russiagate campaign say that Butina was a victim of strong-arm tactics by the FBI. Then, Google CEO Sundar Pichai testified before the House Judiciary Committee this morning about his company's algorithms and whether they are politically biased, and also about Google's privacy practices. Employees took advantage of the high-profile meeting to raise concerns about the company's harassment and discrimination policies. And then the Supreme Court yesterday declined to review lower court decisions that blocked state efforts to cut off public funding for Planned Parenthood, a move that reveals a split within the court's conservative bloc. And finally, an antitrust lawsuit brought by states over two drugs has exploded into a price-fixing investigation against 16 pharmaceutical companies manufacturing more than 300 drugs. Federal authorities allege that pharma executives fixed prices for generic drugs for years, and the Attorney General of Connecticut is calling it, quote, the largest criminal cartel in the history of the United States, unquote. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to President Trump's comments about the border, the U.S.-Mexican border. President Trump said this morning in a series of tweets that he will call out the military to build a border wall if Democrats in Congress fail to provide the necessary funding for the wall's construction. Democrats, meanwhile, warned that Trump could cause a government shutdown on Friday if the Republican Congress does not approve emergency government funding. We're joined from San Diego, California, by Pedro Rios. He is the director of the American Friends Service Committee's U.S.-Mexico Border Program and chairperson for the San Diego Immigrant Rights Consortium. Pedro, welcome to Loud and Clear.
Great. Thanks, Brian. It's a pleasure to be on the show again.
Thank you. Pedro, what was your reaction when you saw Trump's tweets this morning?
It still represents the same sort of attempt to shift a narrative about a border being out of control, that there's chaos in border communities, which is not true. And this is something that he's been trying to cement for a while in order to try to get funding for the border wall, especially as we are 2 weeks before the continuing resolution needs to be addressed again, where he's trying to convince Senators Schumer and Nancy Pelosi about funding the border wall. And so it's a concern that he is continuing with this narrative, but not surprising.
Pedro, he tweeted, despite the large caravans that were forming and were, as all caps, of course, forming and heading to our country, people have not been able to get through our newly built walls, makeshift walls and fences, or border officers and military. They are now staying in Mexico or going back to their original countries. ICE, Border Patrol, and our military have done a fantastic, all caps, job of securing our southern border. It really makes it sound like there was a battle. I mean, you're in San Diego right across from Tijuana. It was like a battle, and a combined American military and police forces held back the invading horde. It sounds like that, no? And just contrast what that sounds like with what you have actually experienced or observed yourself being at the border.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I think what Donald Trump and as well as Border Patrol have been trying to depict is a border out of control, that there is a battle here, and it's a crisis that is of Trump's own making. Bringing the military to border communities is creating much more tension, is raising concerns about what their functions are. And the shutdown of ports of entry, for instance, has already created a loss of a lot of money in border communities. And so this crisis is really something of his own making. Certainly there are a lot of concerns about the presence of the military, but border walls have always been here. And most people who are coming from the caravans and otherwise are actually turning themselves in. They are not likely to be jumping over a border wall because their ultimate goal is to apply for asylum, which usually happens at ports, sometimes in between ports, but that's what people are attempting to do, not jump over the fence, but apply for asylum at the ports of entry.
We're joined from San Diego by Pedro Rios. He is the director of the American Friends Service Committee's U.S.-Mexico Border Program. And Pedro was also the chairperson of the San Diego Immigrant Rights Consortium. Pedro, what's the status of people who came in the caravan who are in Tijuana? And again, for people who may not know the geography, what's the relationship between San Diego, where you are, and Tijuana?
Yeah, so San Diego and Tijuana is a dynamic place. We share the world's busiest land port of crossing, where over 130,000 people cross per day. And the militarized border has created a situation where they've had to shut down, or they've made the poor decision of shutting down the port of entry, which has caused a loss of economic opportunities for both Mexicans and people in the U.S. And so our concern is that the Trump administration is using this as an excuse to try to promote an idea that he needs more money for needless border walls.
Yeah. Pedro, Trump, I'm going to go back to one more point that Trump made. He said, a great wall would be, however, a far easier and less expensive solution. We have already built large new sections and fully renovated others, making them like new. The Democrats, however, for strictly political reasons and because they have been pulled so far left, do not want border security. They want open borders for anyone to come in. This brings large-scale crime and disease. I mean, how do you read that in any other way but as an expression of white supremacy and the effort to demonize people coming from Mexico or from Central America? And talk about that, but also talk about how you view the Democrats and where they're going on this issue.
Yeah, I mean, this is absolutely, that's what it is. It's an expression of white supremacy. It's an expression of open racism that then allows other people, it allows a political space for people who espouse a similar sorts of sentiments to then have a green light to move forward and possibly be engaged in harmful actions against people who they deem to be foreign or who are not American enough, as they would say. And I think the Democrats really need to develop a backbone. I mean, they have been some of the proponents of creating border walls in the past. President Bill Clinton was one who passed Operation Gatekeeper, which has led to the increase of migrant deaths.
Pedro, you have experienced the repression firsthand. Your organization has. People have been arrested. What's going on there?
Yeah, so yesterday, over 400 faith leaders came together and they led a march to the border wall where Border Patrol came out in force, dressed in riot gear, ready to shoot tear gas with their gas masks holding, clinging by their belts. And these faith leaders were conducting a nonviolent action, and one of our colleagues was aggressively detained, and we still have not heard about his whereabouts. And it's been nearly 24 hours, and we're still making calls and trying to get more information about ensuring that he's safe and that he hasn't been physically harmed.
That was the voice of Pedro Rios. He joined us from San Diego. Pedro is the director of the American Friends Service Committee's U.S.-Mexico Border Program and the chairperson for the San Diego Immigrant Rights Consortium. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. The following interview was pre-recorded earlier in the day. Since then, the plea hearing for Maria Butina has been rescheduled to Thursday.
Marina Butina, a Russian student and gun rights activist accused of failing to register as a foreign agent, has agreed to plead guilty to one count of conspiracy and to cooperate in ongoing federal, state, and local investigations. Butina is expected to tell a federal court in Washington tomorrow that she was working to establish relationships with American political groups at the direction of an unnamed Russian official. We're joined from New York by Jim Kavanaugh. He's the editor of thepolemicist.net. Jim, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Jim, this is way more complicated than it's supposed to be. This is a nonsensical charge. she's going to plead guilty to conspiracy or to conspiring to fail to register as a foreign agent, which half of K Street is guilty of at any given time.
K Street
being the headquarters of Washington lobbying, correct, for our listeners. Like I say, this is nonsensical. So why is it such a big deal?
Because they're trying to establish some kind of network of Russian sleeper cells that are running around changing American politics on a daily basis or a monthly basis at the whim of, at the orders of the Kremlin. It's kind of nuts. What she is described as doing is what, you know, I went to graduate school with a lot of foreign graduate students, and they were all talking up their home countries and trying to establish better relations with the United States and their home countries and being involved, frankly, in American politics for the causes that they liked and the causes that they were thought were important for their home countries. In my case, it was mostly leftist. In her case, it was mostly rightist. But this is what people do. And, you know, what's being criminalized here is having conversations about what you believe in and what you think is important, and having conversations and meeting people and trying to, quote unquote, influence people to have friendlier relations between your country and the United States. And it's kind of shocking that they went through this whole thing and threw her in jail and in solitary confinement for months. This is really this. And they've given up on all of these phony charges. And this is what the prosecutors do. They leak. Now, this is a great example of how prosecution gets to leak all this information over months and months and months that sets the public up to believe that this is a certain kind of person. And at the end of the day, oh, we didn't really mean that. That wasn't really true. She wasn't really trying to use sex. Being a graduate student wasn't a cover story. She really was interested in her studies. So all of this stuff gets dropped away, and you have this charge, which is a charge of not only failing to fill out a form, but conspiring to fail to fill out a form.
And remember, they arrested her because they said she was a flight risk.
Right.
Because she had pulled a U-Haul truck up in front of her apartment. I can't remember what state it was, but she was
South Dakota.
I think she was driving to South
Dakota. Driving to South Dakota with her boyfriend. He was moving there.
Once she was on the road, the FBI could have never caught her.
Right.
Because with that U-Haul, you know, that's why they had to move fast. That's why they had to pounce on her.
The FBI once followed me all the way from my house in Virginia to Warren, Ohio, to my aunt's funeral, because they thought I was a flight risk. That's what they do. If they want to follow her to South Dakota, believe me, they would follow her to South Dakota. I think they didn't want to make the drive, and they just decided to grab her to save themselves
and
the
trouble.
And also
the headlines that she was a flight risk. I mean, that becomes the
basis. Which was a lie.
And it becomes the basis for, like, not giving her bail.
Yeah, exactly.
So you put her in jail. You put her in solitary confinement. You say, hey, Maria, guess what? No matter if the thing that we said about you isn't true, if the thing we said about you, the sexist thing that we said about you, that you were trading sex for political favors, in fact, wasn't true, even though your name has been put through the mud, even if all of that we said isn't true, this is your new life, mm-hmm, Maria. Mm-hmm. You're going to spend in solitary confinement, or, Maria, you can plead guilty to conspiring to not fill out this form, in which case we're going to put you on a plane and send you back to Russia, and your ordeal is going to end. What would you like to do, Maria? I mean, John, does it feel familiar to you in terms of your personal experience?
Oh, boy, that is exactly what they do. And, you know, what makes this a particular miscarriage of justice, too, is if you look at the federal sentencing guidelines for a ridiculous, quote-unquote, crime like this, the sentencing guidelines are 0 to 6 months in prison. This would be a first offense, which would be zero. She might get 12 months of probation. But she's been in solitary confinement all this time. Talk about overkill. And Brian, before we went on the air, you said something that was, I think, very important and very interesting. When the prosecutors leaked this specious information that she was trading sex for some kind of insider information, and it turned out to be completely fabricated by the prosecutors, the judge agreed. The judge criticized the prosecutors and then sent her right back to solitary confinement again.
I think the judge said, you couldn't figure out that this was a joke. I figured it after months and months of investigation. I figured it out like in 2 minutes. The judge said something like that.
And then sent her right back to solitary again.
But then goes along with the prosecution.
Exactly right.
You know, as you know, John, I mean, you can't fight this unless you're a billionaire or a multimillionaire. You're going to run out of money, at least. And psychologically, you're in solitary confinement. I mean, you're in a foreign country in a foreign prison in solitary confinement for months and months. Your lawyers are saying, you can't afford to pay for us anymore. What are you going to do? Of course you're going to plead guilty to something that's not going to get you any jail time, but it's going to give the Mueller investigation the headlines they want.
It's about headlines. Mm-hmm. That's all they need. Because everybody's eyes have already glazed over about the Russia investigation. Nobody's, except us, which is sort of a punishment. And Jim Kavanaugh, it's a form of punishment. But given the headlines, I think if you did a poll right now with most Americans would not know who Maria Butina is.
Correct.
But let's say the people who do know her, and you ask them this question, was she here working on behalf of Vladimir Putin and the Russian Federation? Was she trying to meddle in American politics? Was she trying to infiltrate the NRA for Putin? I think the people who have paid attention would say categorically, yes, she was, because of the headlines.
That's right.
But here's another part of the Maria Butina story. She's actually supported by Alexei Navalny. Now, who's Navalny? He's Vladimir Putin's political opponent. She wasn't with Putin. She was with the Putin opposition. This woman got caught in the crossfire. She got caught in the crossfire of what we call, here at Sputnik anyway, Russiagate, or the Russia witch hunt. Let's say call it the Russia witch hunt, because that's what it is. She was a witch. What made her a witch? It wasn't really what she did. It was that she was Russian, and she was here at the wrong time. And because she was trying to be self-promoting or promoting her causes or whatever she was doing, the things that literally tens of thousands of people do, and she was a Russian, that's why she spent the last 5 months in solitary confinement. Go ahead.
And it's worth noting that even the time summary of this, the prosecutors acknowledged in the court papers that she generally wanted a graduate degree and was not simply posing. There is no mention of her having connections to Russian intelligence services. So this is, you know, she had a connection to some Russian guy who, you know, used to work in the government or was a senator, a Russian senator or something. But the word agent comes across, oh, she was a foreign agent. That must mean she was a spy. And that's going to be the impression that's given. She didn't register as a foreign agent. And I've seen this on Twitter. Intelligent people saying, if she was an agent, that means she was a spy.
Right.
Her organization in Russia, the Right to Bear Arms organization, they were actually shut down by the Russian government because of their failure to fill out certain forms that an organization needs to fill out in Russia. I mean, if they were really Russian agents, would they be shut down? Would they really be the friends? Would she really have been the friend of Navalny? I mean, when you actually get into the details rather than the headlines, the story just doesn't add up. It doesn't add up, but it doesn't need to add up. All it needs is the headline. Jim Kavanaugh, we have about 45 seconds left. Okay, she's going to plead. She's going to get sent back to Russia. Her ordeal ends. But it seems to me that the ordeal of what's going on in America is going to continue. It's going to deepen. It's going to intensify. Nothing's going to stop it. This thing has its own sort of incentive, its own motive, its own objectives. And it's really not to stop Russia taking over America. It's got a larger agenda, I think. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, it's to paint everything as being all dissidents and all dissident political activity as being coming from Russia. And, you know, the Gilets Jaunes, the Yellow Jackets in France now, Russia created this. The NRA, Russia created it. I mean, how silly all of this is. But that's what it is. And on the other hand, I think it's a certain sense in which they want to get rid of her and get, because they're moving away on the Trump line from the Russia thing to the maybe obstruction of justice or finance corruption, finance, you know, not declaring financial contributions, campaign contributions. So they're not going to come up. There's no connection to Russian intelligence services here. So they're floating around here. They're fishing around for things to create headlines, as you say, that the Mueller investigation is finding all these important things about Russian influence and Russia spying.
I want to read with some admissions, sort of admissions against interest by the New York Times in their story today about Maria Butina. Maria Butina, the Russian woman accused of running a secret campaign to influence powerful American conservatives, has agreed to plead guilty to conspiring to act as a foreign agent, bringing the case to a close. But in court papers laying out the plea deal, the portrayal of Ms. Butina is far tamer than the narrative the government put forward after her arrest in July. Far tamer?
There was no case in the first place. That's what it comes down to. Well, we'll leave it there. We were joined from New York by Jim Kavanaugh. Jim is the editor of thepolemicist.net. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Google CEO Sundar Pichai testified before the House Judiciary Committee this morning about his company's algorithms and whether they are politically biased, and about Google's privacy practices. Employees took advantage of the high-profile meeting to raise concerns about the company's harassment and discrimination policies. We're joined from San Diego by Dr. Robert Epstein. He's the senior research psychologist at the American Institute for Behavioral Research and Technology. Welcome back, Dr. Epstein.
Always a pleasure.
Dr. Epstein. There is perhaps no one who has followed the Google Corporation and its different iterations, including its parent group Alphabet, more closely than you. What did you take from today's testimony?
I was a little disappointed, I would say. I mean, what Mr. Pichai was doing was just repeating things which his mentor said over and over again for years. That's Eric Schmidt. And so he also seemed to borrow a few lines from Mark Zuckerberg. He just kept saying over and over again, we'll look into that. Then he said, this is our policy, in answer to a lot of questions. You know, he basically didn't tell too many outright lies, a couple of them, but not too many outright lies. He just gave very, very misleading answers over and over and over again. So it was a little bit painful for me to listen to, frankly.
Yeah. And what about the issue of how Google is monetizing data? Did that come up? It seems like it should be a big part of this story, a big part of this hearing.
Well, that wasn't a big part of it. You know, that was mentioned, and then he simply said in response to that, "Well, you know, we don't sell user data." But you know, that's again, that's been the line from Google a long time. But there's really not much difference between monetizing the data, using it as leverage, so that advertisers will pay you money to connect with customers, and selling the data. There's really not much difference. And as someone in marketing explained to me, once you hook up an advertiser with one of Google's users, well, that advertiser now has direct contact with the user. They get all kinds of information about the user. So Google has, in fact, acted as a middleman and has sold the information about the user to the advertiser. So again, lots of misleading statements. As I say, very frustrating for me to watch.
It seemed as if the Republicans on the committee were taking the lead in terms of attacking the Google executives. And then you have the Democrats like Gerald Nadler of New York jumping in to defend Google. I want to just get your take on all of that. Here's Nadler's comments. I must dispense with the complete illegitimate fantasy dreamed up by some conservatives that Google and other platforms have anti-conservative bias. Did you hear Nadler say that? And what was your reaction to that part of the hearing?
Well, I did hear that, and I heard how politicized this whole hearing was. Over and over again, the Republicans attacking and the Democrats defending. You know, and again, just very simple facts being glossed over, the fact that 95% of contributions from Google employees go to Democrats, the fact that, you know, that one-hour video that got leaked from the company, it showed all of Google's leaders, including Sundar Pichai, just distraught over the fact that Trump won the presidency, the recent leaked emails from inside the company, showing Google employees literally planning to discredit Trump, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, the clear and extreme political leanings of Google, and I happen to sympathize with those leanings, but that's beside the point, but the clear political leanings of Google, crystal clear, with, you know, Pichai just glossing over them, the Republicans trying to bring that point up, the Democrats just absolutely brushing it aside over and over again. It was painful to watch, as I said, because, you know, I only wish, frankly, that I were in that room, sitting in one of those chairs, and that we would just let me loose. Because if you let me loose, I would ask really tough questions.
Dr. Epstein, John Kiriakou here. I wanted to ask you also if you think that any of this is going to change next month when the Democrats take over leadership in the House. Is this a political issue that we're talking about here, or is it a policy issue?
Well, one would hope it's a policy issue, but of course we're going to find that in the House of Representatives, starting in January, February, no one's going to be attacking Google, or it will be, you know, the minority attacking Google, which doesn't work very well, as we've seen over and over again with the Republicans in charge. So, you know, Google is moving towards safer ground, and I can tell you now, on the record, just a tiny glimpse here of what I'm going to be releasing soon, but you know, I did election monitoring in 2016, while I did it again in 2018, and there is absolutely no question that Google's algorithm helped to swing a number of races toward the Democrats. So again, absolutely absurd that you know, Pichai would deny that that Google has strong political bias, and he was even asked whether he thought that Google could influence an election. And he said, "Oh no, people get their information from lots of places." Well, of course they get information from lots of places, but you know, all those other places where people get information are in competition with each other. No one's in competition with Google. And people trust Google far more than they trust any other media source. They think falsely that an algorithm gives them objective and impartial information. And of course, that is absolutely ludicrous. The algorithm is programmed by Google employees who continue to make changes in it more than 600 times a year, manual adjustments. I just wish I had been one of those chairs, because, as I say, I would ask tough questions.
You know, this is the thing, too. We talk about this. We've talked about it a couple of times on this show. And every once in a while, there will be congressional hearings. But it's as though it's the issue's getting no traction among the public. I think people ought to be outraged that these gigantic companies are actually swinging races across the country. This is exactly what we should not be allowing in a functioning democracy. And it's as though there's no outrage.
Well, it goes way beyond that, because Google is impacting the thoughts, the feelings, the attitudes, the beliefs, the purchases, the voting preferences of 2.5 billion people around the world, and that number is going to swell to over 4 billion within the next 3 years. So we're talking about influence that is beyond anything anyone ever imagined. Talk about world domination. You know, with the Democrats back in control of the House of Representatives in January, I don't think there'll be any more hearings, frankly. If there are any, they'll be benign. It'll just be lip service paid here to the issues. And look at it this way. In general, since these companies help the Democrats, they're not going to do anything. And since the Republicans hate regulation so much, even they aren't going to do anything. So in the U.S., we are completely stuck. We are stuck here. The EU is less stuck. They are taking on, at least so far, they are taking on Google very strongly, and they've started taking on Facebook. In the U.S., we are helpless. We are at the mercy of these companies.
Yeah, we truly are.
Dr. Epstein, Monopoly Man, was in the hearings and, of course, making fun out of Google as a monopoly and activist. Who attends congressional hearings dressed as the mustachioed Monopoly mascot returning to Capitol Hill on Tuesday to attend a hearing with the Google CEO. It's a joke, but it's a poignant joke, and it is a monopoly. And in fact, I would say the monopoly power, the actual power exercised by a monopoly like Google, is far beyond even the monopoly power exercised by some of the early monopolies, like when you think of Standard Oil. Because Standard Oil wasn't in everyone's home at a particular moment influencing what they thought, what they were looking for, how they might vote. It's a staggering level of power beyond which maybe has ever existed inside the United States or anywhere.
Well, that's what I'm saying, and that's what I study, and I look at those numbers every day. And if you or anyone or any member of Congress could look at the numbers that I see every day, you would be horrified. Everyone would be horrified at the power that this company has to shift opinions and votes with no one aware that they're being manipulated. But again, the members of this committee in Congress, they didn't ask any of the tough questions. And even on some very simple questions, they just let Pichai get away with a very, very misleading answer. For example, at one point he was asked, well, if you delete your data, you, the user, delete your data from Google, is it really deleted or is it just hidden? And Pichai said, oh, well, it takes time for the deletion to propagate through our system, but yes, it's really deleted. Okay, if you read Google's terms of service carefully, it says it might take up to 6 months to delete your data, number one. And number two, it also says, and we have a right to preserve your data indefinitely if it serves the company. That's what it says. So, you know, this is just nonsense. It's evasiveness. It's just misleading answers. And we need to do better. You know, I occasionally, now and then, in the last year or two, I've gotten the impression that, you know, maybe, you know, people are getting educated about these issues. And maybe they're, you know, we might be protected from these companies at some point. When I see a hearing like this, I wonder if that in fact is true.
Dr. Robert Epstein is our guest. Dr. Epstein, is this just the beginning of where Google executives have to make a trek up to Capitol Hill every so often to say this or that? And do you expect Congress to do anything?
Well, I don't think there are going to be many more hearings in the House of Representatives because with the Democrats back in power, I just don't think there's going to be the motivation there. I don't think Congress in general is going to act to restrict the activities of Google and Facebook and Twitter. I just don't think it's going to happen, unfortunately, partly because, you know, people just don't understand the issues, the technical issues, well enough. But the main reason, as I said a little earlier, is because these companies right now, you know, serve the Democrats. And so the Democrats like these companies quite a bit. They also get a lot of campaign contributions from them. And the Republicans don't like regulation. So, no, I don't think Congress is going to help us. I think that what we really have to be doing is setting up monitoring systems. And I'm working on that. I've set up two monitoring systems so far and working on expanding that. And, you know, I think there are things we can do as individuals to protect our privacy. You know, your listeners should check out the new film, the documentary film, The Creepy Line. It's on iTunes now. It's on Amazon, and it's free for Amazon Prime members to watch. And it's a great film, and it talks all about these issues, the censorship, the manipulation, the surveillance, and it focuses quite a bit on Google and also on my research as well. And if people want to support my work or they want to get access to some of my scientific or popular publications, they can go to mygoogleresearch.com, mygoogleresearch.com. Again, the other link for information about the film is thecreepyline.com.
Important. Check out those websites. We were joined from San Diego by Dr. Robert Epstein. He's the senior research psychologist at the American Institute for Behavioral Research and Technology. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Supreme Court yesterday declined to review lower court decisions that blocked state efforts to cut off public funding for Planned Parenthood, a move that reveals a split within the court's conservative bloc. We're joined from Detroit by Julie Hurwitz. She's a civil rights attorney and partner in the law firm of Goodman, Hurwitz & James. Welcome back, Julie.
Great to be here.
Julie, before we talk about this split in the conservative bloc, which I think is fascinating because this conservative bloc is so new, tell us why this decision to not review the lower court findings is so important vis-a-vis Planned Parenthood and Medicaid.
Well, it's important for a pretty significant reason, and that is, separate and apart from the rights that women have to control their bodies, this case represents a judicial recognition that individuals whose rights are affected by federal laws or by state action have an individual right to go to court and to challenge the violations of those rights. And that is an issue that has been evolving or devolving quite a bit over the last 10 years or so, where the Supreme Court has been narrowing and whittling away at individuals' rights to seek justice in court when their rights have been violated by certain actions that are governed by legislation.
So the Supreme Court, I'm looking at the Washington Post, declined Monday to review lower court decisions that blocked state efforts to cut off public funding for Planned Parenthood, a move that suggests a majority of the court may be steering clear of controversial issues. This would be the issue of abortion, of course. Now, what does that mean? So the Supreme Court declined to overturn or to review a lower court decision that blocked, that stopped state governments from cutting off public funding, meaning Medicaid funding, funding for poor people and poor women in particular who might have gotten that funding through Planned Parenthood, which offers a variety of health care services for women, but would also include contraception and abortion services. So, Julie, what you're saying is that individuals were able to bring this action, individual women who had standing, for instance, because they would be harmed by the state court. And what this ruling suggests is that individuals can take their own individualized actions against state legislatures in their votes that deny them rights that they have, economic and social rights that they have, organic fundamental rights. Is that what you're saying?
Basically. I mean, the state passes a law. So in this case, the states of Kansas and Louisiana each passed laws which restricted access to abortion and various forms of birth control. And the question is, this was a legislative act that pertains specifically to funding of organizations. And so one might argue that individuals who might be affected by the funding scheme are not mentioned in the statute as having the right to seek a remedy in court if they are deprived access as a result of this legislation that cut back on funding. Normally, a law like that can only be challenged by the organization itself. And what the court said here is that because the legislation had such an impact on the rights of individual recipients, they themselves have the right to go to court to challenge the decision to cut off that funding. And that's very significant that the courts in both of those circuits recognize that individual private right of action. And it is somewhat shocking to me that this court, the Supreme Court, and particularly Justices Roberts and Kavanaugh, with a perfect opportunity to further narrow those individual rights, made the decision this time around to leave it alone.
We're joined from Detroit by Julie Hurwitz. Julie's a civil rights attorney, and she's a partner at the law firm of Goodwin, Hurwitz & James. I wanted to ask also what you think, Julie, about this, what appears to be a split among the conservatives. Now, for the Supreme Court to take up a case from the lower courts, they need four justices to say that they want to take up that case. They could only put three together for this case, and it was the three most conservative members.
Justices Samuel Alito Jr., mm-hmm. Neil Gorsuch, and Clarence Thomas.
That's right. So notably absent was Brett Kavanaugh.
Yeah, and Justice Roberts. And Justice Clarence Thomas, whenever I say Justice Clarence Thomas, I want to put air quotes,
yes,
or something around
indeed.
The word justice. Justice Clarence, or the other justices too, Justice Clarence Thomas rebuked his colleagues, meaning Kavanaugh and Roberts, for what he said was a dodge, attributing it to their aversion to taking up the issue of abortion that lurked in the case. I'm reading from the Washington Post. Julie, it's kind of significant because obviously Kavanaugh especially is an opponent of abortion.
And he's got a long record of opposition to abortion.
Yeah, but so what does it say to you? Because these justices don't, even though we're told they live in this perfect little bubble world where they sort of have this pristine environment and they make decisions and they call balls and strikes like an umpire, blah, blah, blah. In fact, they're very tuned in. They're political animals. What does it suggest to you that Kavanaugh and Roberts stepped back in this case?
Well, I think that it exemplifies just how political the court really is. And I mean, Justice Roberts, I think I can understand more his motivation to want to leave this one alone, at least for now. And Justice Kavanaugh, again, as a political creature, and for whatever reason, although he's got nothing to lose, doesn't have to run for re-election, he doesn't have to worry about being kicked off the court, none of that. He may just be being politic right now and just sort of stepping back and thinking, well, you know, everybody hates me already in this country. All these women hate me already. I'm going to have the rest of my life to further erode the rights to choice and abortion. It's a little early for me to stick my neck out.
You know what? It's funny that you say that, because that is exactly what popped into my head when I read this. Okay, he's just come through this controversy. He has 20 years ahead of him to strip a woman of her right to choose. Why do it today?
Well, Kavanaugh likes to hang out at these different bars in right. upper northwest Washington. I don't know if he's doing it now, but certainly the people in these different neighborhoods are very pro-women's rights and pro-abortion rights. You know, he lives here, and I think you're right, Julie, and I think, John, you're right. The women who, especially the younger women, it's women of all ages and some men as well, but women in particular led the charge to expose Kavanaugh's position, not simply for what happened when he was in high school, but his political record. The Democrats didn't really do that. They could have scorched Kavanaugh on many fronts, mm-hmm. anti-labor, women's rights, a lot. They basically treated him with kid gloves until the very, very end, when Dr. Christine Blasey Ford came forward and very bravely talked about what had happened when she was in high school with Kavanaugh. She didn't want to come forward. She didn't plan to come forward. And the Democrats were going to let that sail through. It only became an issue, a mass issue, because of the grassroots actions of women and young women. And that did change the political climate, even though Kavanaugh was able to squeak through. Go ahead.
Well, I agree with all of that. And I think that, you know, again, I mean, I don't know the guy. I've only seen him and his behavior through the course of these hearings, and I know of his history. And I think that he felt so wounded, at least from his last testimony before Congress, he was so wounded by these unfair assaults on him, so he claimed, that, I mean, one can only speculate that you can't deny that there's some connection between him not joining with his brother right-wingers on this case at this time, and him continuing to just sort of heal to strengthen himself for the battles that we're all going to be faced with in the future.
Yeah, Julie, in our last minute, if we're right that this was his tepid response to or retreating response to public opinion, mobilized public opinion, doesn't it also suggest, given that there are battles coming forward, that this should be taken as an incentive for grassroots mass mobilization on all the core issues? I mean, that's what's happening right now. That's what we need, it seems to me. 1 minute left.
Absolutely. I think that there's, you know, I teach constitutional litigation at a local law school here, and I start and finish my semesters with the message, the Supreme Court responds to the atmosphere and the climate in which it functions. That's how the Constitution moves forward. That's how it gets reinterpreted. That's how our rights get broadened or narrowed. So it's critical that grassroots efforts and the movement be mobilized as broadly and widely as possible, and never forget to be talking to the Supreme Court.
And let's remember, everybody, Roe v. Wade was 7-2 decision. Mm-hmm. It could have been a broader decision. It was a restrictive decision, which made it vulnerable to state challenges. But that was during the Nixon era. It was a right-wing conservative president. What was different about 1972 was not that we had a progressive left-wing government, but we had a progressive mass movement of women who were fighting for their rights, inspired by the civil rights movement. That's what changed the political climate. If it worked then, it's the thing that will work now. And I think that must be the takeaway.
We're out of time, so we'll have to leave it there. We were happy to be joined from Detroit by Julie Hurwitz. She is a civil rights attorney and partner in the law firm of Goodman, Hurwitz, and James. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
An antitrust lawsuit brought by states over two drugs has exploded into a price-fixing investigation against 16 pharmaceutical companies manufacturing more than 300 drugs. Federal authorities allege that pharma executives fixed prices for generic drugs for years, and the Attorney General of Connecticut is calling it the largest criminal cartel in the history of the United States. We're joined by Tim Horn. Tim is the Director of Medication Access and Pricing at the National Alliance of State and Territorial AIDS Directors. Tim Horn, welcome to Loud and Clear.
Thank you, Brian. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for joining us. I don't know. It's pretty breathtaking, actually, the dimensions, the magnitude of what this is. Just break it down for our audience.
Sure. I mean, it's, you know, the suspected collusion between generic manufacturers, that certainly isn't new. We've been hearing about this for years, and we've been suspecting it for years. What's new, to your point, really is this antitrust suit, which really given voice to, you know, pharmacies and payers, and by extension, U.S. healthcare consumers, with respect to, you know, grossly overpaying for critical generic drug products. And, you know, the claims really are shocking. And I'll explain why. Because, you know, maximizing prescription drug savings is only possible when there is intense pricing competition between generic manufacturers in the U.S. In fact, strengthening and easing this competition really is a cornerstone of virtually all policy efforts to reduce prescription drug and healthcare spending in the U.S. So any collusion between generic manufacturers essentially undermines the one way the U.S. healthcare system does work for consumers, which is competition-generated prescription drug cost controls to rein in commercial insurance premium costs, save taxpayers money, and importantly, to save both insured and uninsured consumers money at the pharmacy.
Tim Horn is our guest. We're talking about this lawsuit alleging price fixing, price gouging, monopoly practices by generic drug dealers. I want to read a couple, they're short paragraphs, but I want to read it. It's from marketwatch.com, and then have you comment a little bit more, Tim Horn. Shares of generic drug makers fell sharply Monday after a Washington Post report that an antitrust lawsuit brought by states over two drugs in 2016 has expanded into a major probe of alleged price fixing across the industry. The case now involves at least 16 companies and 300 drugs, as we said earlier. Executives at more than a dozen companies allegedly conducted business over steak dinners, cocktail receptions, and on golf courses using an insider shorthand, the paper reported. The quote, sandbox, close quote, was the word they used to describe the market for generic prescription drugs where everyone was expected to agree on prices and ensure that all companies made profits. So what we have, it seems, you're at the third tee. You have the silence, the privacy of the moment out on the third tee. You're a business executive representing one generic drug company, presumably in competition with another generic drug company, but you make an agreement that inside the so-called sandbox, which is the market for generic drugs, you're going to fix the price at a certain level so that you can all maximize profits. And as a consequence, consumers, and we're not consumers, we're patients who need drugs, actually have to pay additional money that we would not be otherwise paying so that they can maximize profits for themselves and for their investors. In other words, it's the opposite of actually providing healthcare for people. It's just a kind of thievery. Well, it's not a kind of thievery. It is thievery.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that when we do think about generic drug pricing in the U.S., there are a number of different challenges that are well recognized in terms of, like, you know, keeping drug prices low. And some of those might, you know, root back to where there are your shortages of the actual or the active pharmaceutical ingredient or manufacturing problems. And I think that we know these challenges, and these challenges are bad enough. So when we start to see price fixing by generic manufacturers, you know, which, by the way, are largely painted as the saviors of our ailing drug pricing systems in the U.S., really simply shouldn't be a factor here. And I think the one point to make here is that, you know, generic drug costs have remained relatively steady in recent years, and taken as a whole, really have, you know, saved us, you know, billions of dollars a year, you know, compared with brand name drug prescribing. And, you know, the antitrust suit, you know, isn't one of its kind. I mean, we've been seeing reports for years in terms of what's actually happening in the generic space. For example, the U.S. Government Accountability Office released a report in 2016. And what it did was that it looked at a group of about 1,441 established generic drugs, or basically generic drugs that have been with us, you know, from 2012 through 2015, in which there's been a very steady market. And here's the thing, 315 of those experienced price increases of 100% or more. Of those 315 generic drugs, 58% experienced increases between 100 and 200%. And 48 of those, or 15%, experienced increases of 500% or higher, and 4.8% of which experienced increases of 1,000% or higher. Now, some of those, you know, do loop back to, you know, some of the known variables in a drug pricing. But if any of these, you know, do circle back to collusion between generic manufacturers, then we can see where the root of the problem is. And this is certainly a problem, you know, that can be avoided.
We're joined by Tim Horn. Tim is the Director of Medication Access and Pricing at the National Alliance of State and Territorial AIDS Directors. We're talking about this scandal, this lawsuit about a scandal, which is price fixing by generic drug makers. Tim, you know, I have a family member who takes medicine every day, and if they buy the brand name for the medicine, it costs $120 or $140 for a 90-day supply of this daily pill that has to be taken. Now, if they buy the generic medicine, it's 25% the cost of that. You know, it's or even less. It's about $20-$25, something like that. Again, I think some people, well, I think most people don't really understand what's the difference between a generic drug and a brand name drug. And if you can make a big price savings like that, like it's 25% the cost of a brand name drug, why wouldn't everyone do it? And is there a difference in quality between generic drugs and brand name drugs?
No. And because a generic drug, it has to show, or the manufacturer of a generic drug has to show that it is equivalent, that it contains the exact same active ingredient at the exact same dose and the exact same concentration, and that it achieves the exact same level in the human body. So that is what the FDA requires. And based on that, there should be any changes in quality. Now, while some generics, you know, do have some, you know, different inactive ingredients, you know, compared to the brand name manufacturers, the overall safety and efficacy should absolutely be the same.
Tim Horn is our guest. Tim, you're the Director of Medication Access and Pricing at the National Alliance of State and Territorial AIDS Directors. What is your organization? What does it do?
We are primarily focused on fair pricing for both brand and generic drug products for HIV, for hepatitis C virus, and also for various drugs that are associated with drug users' health. For example, naloxone for overdoses.
And let me ask you another question, because you are clearly an expert on this subject. A patent for a brand name drug lasts a certain number of years. I believe it's 17 years, which means that there can't be a generic produced during that time period. It's a monopoly, a drug. It can only be, the FDA has licensed it. It can be sold by a company. The company, as a consequence, can jack up the price or have a very high price. And there's no competition whatsoever. Do you believe that we should move to a different system of pricing? In other words, to get rid of the patent concept altogether, perhaps a different way of financing drug research, and thus trying to make pharmaceuticals that cost so much money in the United States compared to, say, Mexico or Canada or almost anywhere, they cost so much money. Must there not be a change in the system so that Americans don't have to pay extortionate prices for medicine that they require?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. Now, while I personally do not believe that we, you know, should do away with our system writ large, simply because I do believe the intellectual property and the patents, you know, does essentially, you know, drive the potential for profits, and with it the ingenuity, which I think is a tremendously robust, you know, here in the U.S. in particular. However, I don't think that we are above, you know, any sort of patent reform that allows generics to enter much earlier in the stage. And I think, sort of circling back to what we're seeing here, is that, you know, that the challenges, that the challenges to securing lower cost, you know, generic drug products are significant enough. We certainly do not need, you know, generic manufacturers, you know, sort of entering into you know, clandestine agreements with each other to sort of essentially avoid what they're supposed to be doing, you know, all along, which is engaging in competition with each other to keep those prescription drug prices low. And I will add that, you know, should collusion be proven in a court of law, we're going to need a lot more than just criminal punishment here. We're going to need federal and state policies to prevent collusion and artificially induced price hikes occurring in the future.
Yeah, Joseph Nielsen, the Assistant Attorney General in Connecticut in charge of antitrust investigations, said this was the largest cartel in the history of the United States. It seems, Tim, 30 seconds left, that when corporations and companies do these kind of large-scale criminal activities, if in fact it's proved that they were, they perhaps face civil fines. They generally don't go to jail. A jail is usually, you know, considered like an important part of deterring crimes from being committed once again. 30 seconds left. Will anybody, if this is true, go to jail?
I seriously doubt it. I think that some, you know, significant fines will be levied. I do wish that they would, you know, hold the prison as a potential option here. But again, it just can't end with this antitrust suit. We're going to need the policies to change the landscape altogether to prevent this from happening ever again.
That's Tim Horn. Tim is the Director of Medication Access and Pricing at the National Alliance of State and Territorial AIDS Directors.
You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear. Thank you.